the inner yard. She said she would die if her neighbor saw it. The G-word topic got to the point where they couldn't speak civilly to each other about it. I think the issue became the site of all the redirected anger about the disease. One day my mom told me she was thinking about really trying to understand my father's point of view. She wanted to resolve the situation so that both could be happy. She knew she didn't want a greenhouse in her backyard. She'd rather have morning glory in all her perennial flower beds than that greenhouse. But she also knew that she wanted my father to be happy and productive. She decided to step back and let him do it. She decided that my dad's happiness meant more to her than either the backyard or the neighbors. As it turns out, that greenhouse kept my dad going long after the doctors had given up on him. He lived for 2.5 more years. At night, when he couldn't sleep because of the chemotherapy, he went out to the greenhouse to see how his plants were doing. In the morning, watering those plants gave him a reason to get up. His greenhouse gave him work to do, something else to concentrate on, while his body collapsed on him. I remember my mom commenting that supporting my dad's desire to build the greenhouse was one of the wisest things she had ever done. Close quote. Initially, the greenhouse was a lose to my colleague's mother, until she subordinated her initial desires to her greater desire for her husband's happiness and welfare. This teaches that when you understand someone, you redefine what win-win is. Nevertheless, she had not initially felt enough respect to want to understand and what was important to her husband, and she wouldn't have made the shift. Interestingly, the synergy that resulted was not a third alternative solution, it was a third alternative attitude or motive. The first alternative was not to have the greenhouse. The second alternative was to let him have the greenhouse grudgingly. The third alternative was to truly understand him, to cheerfully and lovingly find her happiness in his satisfaction at having the greenhouse. This is often the way synergy works. An outside observer might say that it was a compromise, but if you were to talk to this woman, she would surely deny that she was compromising herself. She fulfilled herself in her husband's happiness and well-being. Such attitudinal synergy is a magnificent expression of mature love. Most transactions between people end in compromise, win-lose or lose-win. But third alternative solutions, whether they be in substance, in spirit, or in simply achieving mutual respect and understanding without any agreement at all, are illustrations of transformation. That is, people have been changed. They have become more open in their hearts and minds. They have learned and listened. They see things in new, fresh ways. They have been transformed. Let me describe this in a continuum as we contrast transactional and transformational solutions. Transactional solutions would basically involve lose-win, win-lose, or compromise. But where transformation has taken place, it usually manifests itself in mutual understanding without even agreeing, or in win-lose and lose-win, but with increased understanding and caring. Or perhaps there may be compromise on the issue, but synergy in the relationship. But the highest form of transformation would be synergy on both the issue and on the relationship. I am convinced that most disputes, I mean literally most, could be prevented and solved through synergistic third alternative communication. Suing and the law should be used as the court of last resort. Not the first. A litigious culture is unhealthy for society, destroys trust, gives terrible modeling, and at best results in compromise. I hope someday to join with a corporate general counsel and a federal judge, both of whom practice these ideas with astounding results, in writing a book for attorneys and those who educate and hire attorneys. and also for those who want to solve seemingly intractable problems without hiring attorneys. The title would be Blessed Are the Peacemakers, subtitled Synergy in the Prevention and Settlement of Disputes. New heading: Building a Complementary Team Through Third Alternative Communication. Modeling open third alternative communication is also absolutely necessary in efforts to build a complementary team that we have discussed. Of all the places this kind of modeling should take place, it's with the executive team, because formal leaders have formal authority. They, above all, need to manifest the moral authority inherent in this kind of communication. The second reason is that executives are so visible. Constantly building complementary teams between departments, inside departments, and throughout the entire organization. A complementary team is one where people's strengths are made productive and their weaknesses are made irrelevant by the strengths of others, so that rather than being lonely at the top, they are bonded at the top. That's the essence of a complementary team. This kind of third alternative communication that produces complementary teams can, however, begin at any level. The pragmatic results produced by those at lower levels will convert the cynics at higher levels of the organization, again illustrating that leadership, not just by an individual, but by an entire team, is a choice, not a position. You might ask, where do you start? Simply begin by having open communication between everyone on your team, in your department, or between interdependent teams and departments. Then, as you practice the skills of third alternative communication, people will gradually get to know and like one another, and will become more open, authentic, and real. Mutual respect will develop, and people will increasingly seek to acknowledge the strengths of others and will actively strive to compensate for their weaknesses to make their strengths productive. This produces harmony, like in a musical group or an athletic team. Remember this: when we look through the lens of each other's weaknesses, we make each other's strengths irrelevant and their weaknesses more evident. Now let's look at a film to help illustrate these ideas. This film is called The Street Hawkers. Several years ago, a South African company was opening up a brand new retail clothing store in an old part of town. The day they opened the store, the fruit and vegetable vendors, commonly called street hawkers, flooded back to that central location. They used to occupy that land before the store was built, and they had been selling there for years. Psychologically, they felt that they owned it. They came right back in front of the store on the very day of the new store's opening and set up their fruit and vegetable stands. It made an absolute mess, and it made it difficult for people to get into the store. What would you do if fruit vendors crowded around, messing up the sidewalk, and partially blocked your doorway on the day that you opened your new store? I mean, think about it. Really, what would you do? You have two options, you think. You can either try to control the street hawkers like things by calling the police, make them move, enforce your position as the legal owners of the property. Or, as a second solution, you could let these street hawkers simply have their way and go for lose-win. But there's a third solution. You could treat them like people. You could synergize and come up with a better solution for both of you. The manager of the store could have called the police on these hawkers. Instead, he decided to seek the third alternative. He first listened to their objectives and needs. Then he talked about the store's needs. Together, this most unlikely team of retail managers and street hawkers developed a synergistic plan that worked for both of them. It was better than what either had proposed. We produced a little film on this experience between the new retail store and the fruit and vegetable street vendors. It's called Street Hawkers. I invite you now to watch this video. You can find it on the companion DVD to your book. In it, you will see the kind of synergistic solutions that are developed by people who are truly empowered. You can see from this film how the key to their creative solution was first achieving mutual understanding. You'll also notice the serendipitous benefit, that is, the unexpected consequence that came from this creativity. Serendipity sometimes means happy accident. Something happened that no one initially anticipated. It emerged from trust and relationship. The street hawkers essentially became the security force for the store. Street people know who the thieves are, and the thieves know this. Because pilferage of inventory is a major problem in South Africa, this became a huge benefit. You literally see the building of trust and communication. Trust is then turned into a verb by entrusting a group of people. And then those people live true to that trust and reciprocate it. This is always bonding. It also creates an immune system that has the power to deal with issues or problems that may come down the pike in the future. Many people ask this question: how important are the life cycles of organizations? And is there a third alternative to their eventual decay and death? My answer is, I suggest that there are basically four what we could call Bermuda Triangles which lead to decay, disaster, and death. The first occurs at the idea stage, where a good idea is simply squelched by negative energy, self-doubt, and fear. The second Bermuda Triangle occurs at the production stage, where the great idea is not properly executed. This is where most new organizations fail, perhaps upwards of 90% within 2 years. There is just so much slip between cup and lip, between the great idea and making it happen. The third occurs at the management stage. Production with scalability has been institutionalized so that one can replicate or duplicate the enterprise, such as expanding to another good restaurant. But the producer either tries to do it all, or he or she tries to clone himself or herself. Formal systems are never established to keep things, especially cash flow, in control. The fourth Bermuda Triangle occurs at the change stage, where the organization needs to reinvent itself to adapt to changing market conditions or new opportunities, but gets so bogged down in its own bureaucratic life, rules and regulations, that it can no longer meet and anticipate the needs of targeted customers. Good management teams should have people with qualities that match the needs at all four stages: idea, production, management, and change leadership. Most importantly, the team must have a spirit of mutual respect so that the strengths of each are acknowledged and utilized, and the weaknesses are made irrelevant by the strengths of the others. In other words, you need an entrepreneur, that is the idea person, a producer, a manager, and a team builder leader who helps create the norm of mutual respect and who creates a complementary team with the power to reinvent itself and take it into new life cycles. Here's another constantly asked question. What do you do when you are involved in merger and acquisition work and trying to bring people together from different companies and different cultures? Is there some magic third alternative button to push to achieve interdependence in a global economy? My response is, the reason why most mergers and acquisitions don't work is that they are forcing the processes. It's like bringing about a merger of different DNAs. Have you ever seen a blended family? How hard is it to see that work successfully? It takes tremendous time, persistence, patience, and Indian talking stick communication toward third alternative solutions. In the meantime, I'll guarantee that you'll see the five metastasizing cancers manifesting themselves. You know, contending, comparing, competing, criticizing, and complaining. Remember, with people and cultures, fast is slow, and slow is fast. With things, this isn't the case. Fast is fast. But with people, efficiency or speed is ineffective. I have learned this personally the hard way. but it has powerfully reinforced what I'm sharing with you now. There must be an open, mutual, respectful communication of the value of the different approaches if you are to produce a third alternative culture. This often requires new formal leadership. Once I was working with a big company up in Canada with a very mature, empowered culture. Because leaders in the headquarters of the company in the States were opening up operations in all kinds of other countries, they wanted to establish some central policies. But these policies assumed cultures far less developed and mature than the Canadian one. Canadian management asked me if I could help them maintain their relative independence and empowerment and not get sucked into roles and policies that were geared to immature cultures and the weakest links in the value chain. I was happy to help. Once the American executives came to realize that they were not interdependent with Canada, that they could use Canada as a model of what was possible, that Canada's mature culture was more productive, leaner, and more profitable, with far greater empowerment, less bureaucracy, and less tape, they started pointing to the Canadian operation as a model organization, which the less developed cultures could emulate. The key is, don't artificially force interdependency. It has to come naturally through people getting to know and understand and trust each other. Then they can become creative. Until this happens, people see interdependency as dependency. Chapter 11. One Voice, Pathfinding, Shared Vision, Values, and Strategy. Think about this brief excerpt from Alice in Wonderland by Lewis Carroll. One day Alice came to a fork in the road and saw a Cheshire cat in a tree. "Which road do I take?" she asked. His response was a question, "Where do you want to go?" "I don't know," Alice answered. Then said the cat, "It doesn't matter." Remember, acquiring the eighth habit is an inside-out sequential process. Like any habit, it is a combination of attitude, skill, and knowledge. We've discussed the attitude of trim-tabbing initiative. We've discussed the skills of building trust and seeking third alternatives. The four roles of leadership represent third alternative leadership and influence. They give you knowledge of the principles of transformational leadership. Again, this influence begins with modeling trustworthiness so that people will have confidence in you. But as you know, they need more than your trustworthiness, because good intentions do not compensate for bad judgment. People need a model to see how they can work and lead in a different way, different from what they are used to, different from the culture of the organization they work in, different from the controlling transactional traditions of the industrial age. Your most important modeling will be to show others how a person who has found his or her voice acts inside the other three primary roles of a leader: pathfinding, aligning, and empowering. So to help you model these three roles, I will begin the chapters covering the three remaining roles of leadership by first identifying the myth and the reality that surrounds each role, and second, describing three contrasting alternatives for approaching each role. The key in any challenge, of course, is to always seek the higher third alternative. In this chapter, we take on the leadership challenge of uniting people who are diverse in their strengths and ways of seeing the world into one voice, one great purpose. It's the role of pathfinding, shared vision, values, and strategic priorities. Let's begin by looking first at the pathfinding myth, reality, and alternatives. Here is the myth: that mission statements and strategic priorities are developed by those who know best, that is, the people at the top. That's the old paradigm. But here is the reality: mission statements and strategic priorities that are developed in a rush by those at the top and then announced are forgotten. Without involvement or strong identification, there will be no commitment. That is the new paradigm. So the first alternative to the pathfinding role of leadership would be to announce vision, values, and strategy to your team or organization without any real involvement on their part. The second alternative would be to get excessive involvement and get bogged down in paralysis by analysis and committee-itis, have extensive off-sites and endless discussions, almost working on the assumption that you don't need to execute strategy or to empower. The third alternative would be to not only reasonably involve people in the process of developing the vision, mission, and strategy, but also recognize that if you build a strong enough culture of trust and are personally trustworthy yourself, the power of identification is equal to the power of involvement. Allow me to illustrate this third alternative. I've been long amazed at the consistent, absolutely extraordinary levels of service I've received while staying at Ritz-Carlton hotels. As I've become better acquainted over the years with Horst Schulze, the hotel chain's former longtime president and COO, I better understood how the remarkable culture was created. Under Schulze's direction, the Ritz-Carlton Hotel Company won an unprecedented 2 Malcolm Baldrige National Quality Awards in the service category. I once interviewed Horst for an internationally syndicated column I was writing. I asked him, "How would you define leadership?" Here was his response. "Leadership is creating an environment in which people want to be part of the organization and not just work for the organization. Leadership creates an environment that makes people want to rather than have to do. It is a business imperative to create that environment. I must give purpose, not just work and function. As a business person, I am obligated to create an environment where people feel part of something, feel fulfilled, and have purpose. It is purpose, it is value in their lives that leads people to truly give of their minds. Then you are getting the maximum from them, and you are giving the maximum to the person. Anything less is irresponsible to the organization and demands more handling by the individual." He goes on, "When you see people only as fulfilling a function, you're treating them like a thing, like the chair you're sitting on. I don't think we as humans can assume the right to do that. None of us want to be just something standing in a corner. We found the greatest satisfaction for an employee is to feel part of something and to feel trusted to make decisions and to contribute." Going on with this quote, "Everyone is a knowledge worker in their specific area, and undoubtedly the dishwasher has more knowledge about their situation than I have. So that dishwasher can contribute to the improved environment, work conditions, productivity, lack of dish breaking, etc. They can contribute their knowledge in their area tremendously. I had a young man from Nairobi who joined me as a dishwasher in the hotel about 16 years ago. He couldn't speak proper English, but he was very hard working. After a while, they offered him a job in room service, then as a room service leader, then a lobby attendant, then a bartender. Then he became an assistant lobby manager. He's now the food and beverage director. He's the number 2 man in the hotel, and he started as a dishwasher. When I was 16 years old, my mother took me to the hotel with my little suitcase to begin my apprenticeship. There were all these important guests, and I thought they were all so above me. But I got close to a remarkable 70-year-old head waiter with whom I worked as an apprentice. When he moved into the room, you knew he was present. He was excellent, and there was an admiration for him. He always looked out for excellence in how he appeared, what he said, and how he did things. I saw in this maitre d' that if you do things exceptionally, you're just as important as they are. I realized that I could be just as important if I do what I do right, no matter what it is. In fact, that idea has become the motto of Ritz-Carlton. We are ladies and gentlemen serving ladies and gentlemen. Close quote. Over the past 22 years, we have surveyed some 5 million people, seeking to understand the characteristics and competencies of effective leaders and managers. One of the most striking findings from this vast study was this. Managers are typically rated high on work ethic modeling, but low on their ability to provide focus and clear direction pathfinding. As a result, people are neither clear about nor accountable to key priorities, and the whole organization fails to execute. The disconnect is this. People are working harder than ever, but because they lack clarity and vision, they aren't getting very far. They, in essence, are pushing a rope with all of their might. So whereas modeling inspires trust, pathfinding creates order without demanding it. As soon as the people involved agree upon what matters most organizationally, they share the criteria that will drive all decisions that follow. This clarifying communication gives focus. It creates order. It creates stability. It also creates agility, which we will explore later in the empowering role. So vision, on a personal scale, translates into pathfinding in an organizational setting. Whereas individually you identify what you see to be significant, now your challenge and role is to create a shared view of what is significant, of what is important, of what matters most. Consider for a moment the following questions you might ask about your employees. Do people clearly understand the organizational goals? And are they committed? Helping people clearly understand and get committed to significant goals requires you to involve them in decision-making. Together, you determine the destination of the organization. That's vision and mission. Then everyone in the organization will have ownership in the path that leads to the destination. That deals with values and the strategic plan. In determining together what is most important to an organization or team, you need to come to grips with the realities you face. Once you understand those hard, cold realities, then together you work until a shared vision and value system are embodied in some kind of a mission statement and strategic plan. Speaking of the need to first become grounded in foundational realities, author Clayton M. Christensen wrote, "Every company and every industry works under certain forces, laws of organizational nature, that act powerfully to define what that company can and cannot do. Managers faced with disruptive technologies fail their companies when those forces overpowering them. By analogy, the ancients who attempted to fly by strapping feathered wings to their arms and flapping with all of their might as they leaped from high places invariably failed. Despite their dreams and hard work, they were fighting against some very powerful forces of nature. No one could be strong enough to win this fight. Flight became possible only after people came to understand the relevant natural laws and the principles that defined how the world worked. That is the law of gravity. Bernoulli's principle and the concepts of lift, drag, and resistance. When people designed flying systems that recognized or harnessed the power of these laws and principles rather than fighting them, they were finally able to fly to heights and distances that were previously unimaginable. So in pathfinding, you must grapple first with four realities, market realities, core competencies, stakeholder wants and needs, and values, before you will fully comprehend and be prepared to execute the pathfinding role. Let's look at each one of these. First, market realities. How do people in your organization or team perceive the marketplace? What is the larger political, economic, and technological context? What's the competitive landscape like? What are the trends and characteristics of the industry? What about the possibility of disruptive technologies and disruptive business models that could make obsolete the entire industry or basic tradition? Now let's look at core competencies. What are your unique strengths? I'm very impressed with Jim Collins' approach to pathfinding. In his book, Good to Great, he presents three overlapping circles which represent your main strengths. He calls it the hedgehog concept. These circles identify three questions. What are you really good at? Maybe even what can you be best in the world at? Second, what are you deeply passionate about? And third, what will people pay for? In other words, what are the human needs and wants being met that would drive your economic engine? The nexus between these three overlapping circles represents the foundation of your value proposition. If we were to ask one more question, what does your conscience counsel? We would have a whole person approach. Body, standing for the economic engine. Mind, be best at. Heart, passion. And spirit, conscience. The overlapping of all four areas is where your voice is to be found. As discussed before, this approach would apply to an individual finding his or her voice, as well as to an organization finding its voice. Now let's look at stakeholder wants and needs. Think of all the different stakeholders. First and most importantly, the target customers. What do they really want and need? What are their issues, problems, and concerns? What do their customers want and need? What is the market reality of the industry in which they operate? What possible technologies or business models could disrupt them or make them obsolete? What about the owners, those that have supplied the capital or paid the taxes? What are their wants and needs? What about the associates, the employees, your co-workers? What are their wants and needs? What about all of the suppliers, distributors, and dealers, the entire supply chain? What about the community and the natural environment? Now let's look at values. What are these people's values? What are your values? What is the central purpose of the organization? What is the central strategy in accomplishing that purpose? What job are they hiring you to do? What are the values that are to serve as guidelines? How are they prioritized in different contexts in times of stress and pressure? Most people have never even decided what matters most to them. They haven't developed the criteria that will inform and govern all of the decisions. And now we're trying to do it for an entire group, team, or organization. Think how complex that is, how interdependent, really how challenging. These are the kinds of questions and issues that must be clarified before you can focus. That is why it takes such character and competence. That is, vision, discipline, and passion, governed by conscience. Pathfinding is the toughest undertaking of all because you deal with so many diverse personalities, agendas, perceptions of reality, trust levels, and egos. This underscores why modeling is the most important and central governing role. If people cannot trust the person and or team initiating the pathfinding process, there will be no identification and involvement will be very dysfunctional. You see, it took the modeling character and the competence of a George Washington to integrate and harmonize the brilliance and differences of a Thomas Jefferson, a John Adams, a Benjamin Franklin, an Alexander Hamilton, and other founding fathers of the American Republic, until finally the Declaration of Independence and the United States Constitution, with its first 10 amendments, called the Bill of Rights, were produced. Accomplishing this pathfinding work was the toughest of all tasks in founding the United States of America. But those visionary guiding documents have enabled the United States to survive major traumas to its national life. The Civil War, the Great Wars, the Vietnam War, Watergate, presidential scandals, and presidential elections. And talk about empowerment. 4.5% of the world's population produce almost a third of the world's goods. New heading: Achieving Shared Vision and Values. People frequently use the analogy of being on the same page or song sheet to describe achieving shared vision and values. It's an excellent analogy because it suggests that there is agreement about what matters most in the organization's vision, values, and strategic value proposition. And when played or sung together, the music is in harmony. Sharing is an interesting word. When I share something with you, I give what I have to you. If you identify with me and believe in what I am about and trust me, then I might simply share with you my vision. You might buy into that vision even more than if you had developed it yourself, because you actually give more credence to my experience than to your own. If, on the other hand, you feel competent and desirous of getting involved, and I simply share or announce to you my plan as our plan, then you have no emotional commitment. It is not shared. You would feel that the mission and value proposition were imposed upon you. We are not on the same song sheet. In short, the mission statement and strategic plan are one thing, but the process of getting everyone on that same song sheet is another thing of equal importance. It is a major undertaking. The leadership work of modeling, that is the first role, is truly manifest in the pathfinding role. Otherwise, people don't get on the same song sheet. They don't emotionally align on the strategic issues, and downstream everything will go awry. Then the only saving grace will be the sheer survival instinct inside of people, so that if the competition is also in disarray, you might survive. But if your main competitors synergistically unite within themselves, particularly if they are world-class, your history. Let's watch a film that helps illustrate this. We'll call this film Goal. If you've ever watched one of your young children or grandchildren play soccer on a weekend morning, you'll get a laugh out of this great little film and will feel like you're right back on the sidelines. Notice the similarities in the challenge you face at work in trying to get everyone focused on the same big goal. Place the DVD in your DVD player now and select Goal from the menu. You'll really enjoy this. New heading: The Pathfinding, or what we could call Focus Tools. The Mission Statement and the Strategic Plan. Pathfinding is for an organization or team what modeling is for an individual. It's deciding what to focus on as an organization, as a team, or as a family. You ask the same kind of values and purposes questions that you do as an individual. Only now the group does it collectively regarding their specific mission. Through an interactive process, you create a written mission statement and strategic plan. That represents basically your value proposition and your goals. The mission statement should encompass your sense of purpose, your vision, and your values. The strategic plan is a clearer description of how you will provide value to your customers and stakeholders. It's your value proposition. It's your focus. It's the organization's voice. In coming up with your strategic plan, you need to know who your customers and stakeholders are, who you want them to be, the valued service or product you are offering them, the job they want you to do for them, and then your plan, including deadlines, to achieve certain goals in getting and keeping customers. For a family, a strategic plan is simply your action plan for realizing your vision and values in everyday life. New heading: Empowering Mission Statements. In my experience, empowering shared mission statements are usually produced when there are four things: enough people, fully informed, interacting freely and synergistically in an environment of high trust. You know what's really interesting? If you have these same four conditions present, most mission statements from all kinds of organizations, all over the world, at every level of the organization, will basically contain the same basic ideas and values. The words may vary, but they usually touch on the four dimensions and needs of life: the physical slash economic, the mental, the emotional, and the spiritual. The power of the Ritz-Carlton Extraordinary Service Culture is its foundational view of people, both of themselves and of their customers. We are ladies and gentlemen serving ladies and gentlemen. The heart of Horst Schulze's leadership is his view of the dignity and need for meaning of the whole person. Remember, only those people who are allowed to tap into the needs and motivations of all four parts of their nature will find their voice and volunteer their highest contributions. For the body, the need and motivation is survival, economic prosperity. For the mind, growth and development. For the heart, love and relationships. And for the spirit, meaning, integrity and contribution. The organization has the same four needs. Survival is the financial health. We could call that the body or body politic of the organization. Second, growth and development, that is economic growth, customer growth, innovation of new products and services, increasing the professional and institutional competency. That represents the mind of the organization, a learning organization. Third, relationships, strong synergy, strong external networks and partnering, teamwork, trust, caring, valuing differences. That would represent the heart of an organization. And fourth, meaning, integrity, and contribution. That is serving and lifting all stakeholders, customers, suppliers, employees and their families, communities, society, making a difference in the world. That would represent the spirit of an organization. So the key to unleashing the power of the workforce is what I call co-missioning. Co-missioning. It's clarifying the mission, vision, and values of the organization in a way that overlaps the four needs of the individuals with the four needs of the organization. Co-missioning. Then, every person's job in the organization ought to be also commissioned to explicitly meet the four needs of both the person and that job. An implicit universal mission statement for an organization would read something like this: to improve the economic well-being and quality of life of all stakeholders. Your organization's departments, teams, or family mission statements would not only embody the spirit of the universal mission statement, but would also represent how you uniquely do that. Your unique gift, capacity, niche, in short, your voice. Again, consider an implicit universal mission statement: to improve the economic well-being and quality of life of all stakeholders. New heading: no margin, no mission. I've always been driven by a sense of mission and purpose, but it was not many years into starting my own company that I was forcibly taught the reality. If there is no margin, there is no mission. In other words, unless you run your enterprise in a way that produces consistent profits over time, eventually you lose your opportunity to deliver on your mission. Most businesses, on the other hand, are so focused on margin and meeting the quarterly numbers that they lose sight of the very vision that inspired them to get into business in the first place. They lose sight of their people and their families and the communities they operate in. They forget how interdependent they are with all of their stakeholders. It is like a social ecology. They lose this sense of social ecology. They lose their sense of mission and contribution. The problems that this latter approach has created have driven many of my professional work with organizations for the last 40 years. There are significant negative consequences that follow from both the mission, no margin, and the margin no mission approaches. Neither approach is sustainable, particularly in today's global economy. The key is to go for both. The key is balance. New heading: Executing the Strategic Plan. A strategic plan, of course, begins with the customer. In a very real sense, there are only two roles in an organization: customers and suppliers. And interestingly, everybody functions simultaneously in both roles, whether inside or outside the organization, either as a customer or a supplier. But everyone functions in both. Everybody means that all stakeholders in the supply chain who make your organization's end product possible, such as those who supply the funds, the credit, those who supply the ideas and labor, those who supply the material, those families who support the employees, and the community environment that permit and nurture the entire supply chain. Since there are only two roles, in the large sense, the essence of good business is the quality of the relationship between customer and supplier. You, the supplier, sell more than goods and services to your many different customers. You are really selling solutions to their problems, jobs that they hire you for in the form of goods and services. To be able to really solve those problems in a way that is more than just a cosmetic pat on the head requires you to deeply understand these different stakeholder needs. You have to pay the price to know what matters most to these people so that you can plan strategically in a meaningful way. Values become priorities in this planning process because principle-based values don't change. Customers will change, and so strategy must adapt. But if your values are tied to changeless principles, you will have a center pin to which you can anchor yourself through all the inevitable changes. So the litmus test of a good mission statement and strategic plan is being able to approach any person at any level of an organization and have them be able to describe how what they do contributes to this strategic plan and is in harmony with the governing values. To use the compass metaphor, they all know which way north is and how their part is moving the organization in the right direction. Once a mission statement and strategic plan are deeply shared, either through identification or involvement, half the battle is won, because the mental, emotional, and spiritual creation has taken place. The physical creation then follows. It's all about executing the strategy, making it happen. Doing, producing, aligning, empowering. This means you need to set up the structure, get the right people in the right jobs with the right tools and support, and then get out of their way and give help as requested. Each sub-organization, committee, board, division, department, project, or team would have to go through a similar two-creation process. The mental, then the physical. The blueprint, then the construction. The writing of the music, then the playing of the music. You see, all things are created twice. Pathfinding is the first creation. It lays down the strategic plan for making things physical, actual, and real. You'll also find that if this process is done well, and if there is deep emotional connection to it, because of the identification and involvement that has preceded it, you'll be able to drive tremendous cost-cutting throughout an organization when needed. Just as an individual gets swallowed up in doing things that are urgent but not important, so does an organization. The culture develops a life of its own. That's why it's necessary to constantly use the overall purpose, values, and strategic plan to focus and drive every other decision you make. It will also give you the awareness and courage to get and stay out of hobbies in your business that are not central to its core purpose. One of the greatest challenges that business leaders encounter is that of working to cascade and translate the corporate vision from 30,000 feet into actionable line-of-sight behaviors among frontline workers to achieve critical objectives. Even if they have been involved in the development of the mission statement and strategic planning process, bringing it down to where the rubber meets the road is not easy. Think of how much more productive we could be if we had the right people working on the right things at the right time. The vital few projects and goals that ultimately matter most. But that's usually the problem. Too often our strategic plans are lofty and vague, and leaders fail to translate strategy into the few critical goals that must be accomplished in the near term. Or just as problematic, strategies are translated into 8, 11, or even 15 new crucial goals, which is far too many priorities to realistically focus on. When you have too many top priorities, you effectively have no top priorities. Regarding strategic goals, it is important that they are few, prioritized, measurable, and inside a compelling scoreboard, so everyone knows exactly what they are and how they are being achieved and measured. Further insight on focusing your team and organization on the few, what we could call wildly important goals, or WIGs, and on the importance of a compelling scoreboard will be given in later chapters. To create an environment of focus and teamwork top to bottom, employees must know what the highest priorities are, buy into them, translate them into specific actions, have the discipline to stay the course, and trust one another and collaborate effectively. Unfortunately, most people don't know where to focus their time and energy because top priorities aren't clearly identified or communicated and measured on a compelling scoreboard. If they are and workers don't feel any ownership or disagree with the strategy and are given competing priorities or are unable to see the link between their tasks and the corporate vision, then the ability of that team or organization to execute that vision is seriously jeopardized. Teamwork is then threatened by low trust, backbiting, faulty systems and process, or too many barriers to action. Organizations that are able to create a shared sense of mission so that each person knows and is passionate about the big why and who, and also to develop a clear line of sight strategy, the how and the when, where departments and teams and individuals are consistently focused on their goals and people are accountable to the organization's few highest priorities, can find their voice and build a powerful principle-centered culture. Therein lies the mother lode of the pathfinding role. Here are three common questions asked about this pathfinding role. First, I have four generations of workers. How do you unite people in shared vision and values when they are so different? My answer is that a principle-centered model is the only one that does apply. Whether you're dealing with old-timers, baby boomers, Generation X, or Generation Y, all of whom come from different value systems and see life through different lenses, there is one thing that unites them all. Timeless, universal principles that can be the basis for developing a common vision and value system. I know I'm making this sound a lot easier than it really is. Nevertheless, by showing respect for each generation of workers and involving them in synergistic communication, I'm convinced a third alternative can be achieved. Remember again the principle: involve people in the problem and work out solutions together. When you do, people become emotionally connected to the solution. When they really understand the depth of the problem and transcend looking at it only through their own generational lens, all of them become part of a social ecology. Another question. You are constantly trying to distinguish between principles and values. This is confusing to me. They seem the same. What do you mean? My response is this. The basic reason you think this way is that most well-developed values are indeed principles or natural laws. In fact, If you involve enough people in developing a value statement, and they are informed and work in an atmosphere of high trust, and communicate openly and synergistically with each other, you will find that the shared values that emerge are essentially principle-based. You will also find that any group that develops a value system in this way will essentially be the same, even though the words may be different. The cultural practices may vary depending on where you are in the world. But my experience around the world is that regardless of the kind of organization, or even the level within the organization, when statements of values are produced in this way, enough people, informed, in an atmosphere of trust, and communicating synergistically, they will all deal with the four basic parts of our nature: body, mind, heart, and spirit, and the four basic needs of both individuals and organizations: to live, to love, to learn, and to leave a legacy. As mentioned, this pertains to both individuals and organizations. But if values are unilaterally developed and announced, they may not be principle-based. After all, even criminals have values. Another common question: is it necessary to write mission statements or do strategic planning sessions off-site? My answer is it all depends. If the product of an off-site experience is mainstreamed for input throughout an entire organization, it can be very successful. But if it produces a mission statement and strategic plan that are simply announced, it will not work. The key is that there must be emotional connection. Otherwise, the criteria developed will not be used to align structures, systems, processes, and cultures. Mission statements that are rushed and announced are forgotten. They're nothing but PR statements. This is often the case with off-site products. Remember, the process is as important and powerful as the product itself, if you want to get emotional connection. Again, this will take a combination of involvement and identification. In other words, the trust in other people's vision is higher than their own, therefore they identify with it. But in the long run, even this identification comes from involvement, if only that one person that they identify with. This means, of course, that there needs to be a process of communication, feedback, openness, and participation in order to get this emotional connection, this identification. Many times I've seen technology used marvelously to produce one iteration after another. A committee of two or three people did the initial wordsmithing of a straw man. Then gradually through feedback, both sharing and listening, it became increasingly better and more deeply reflected the many different interests until there was true cultural connection throughout an entire organization. We have just dealt with the two roles of focus, called modeling and pathfinding. And now we will deal with the next two roles of leadership under the broad heading execution. These are called aligning and empowering. Chapter 12: The Voice and Discipline of Execution. That is, aligning goals and systems for results. Henry Emerson Fosdick once said, "No horse gets anywhere until it is harnessed. No steam or gas ever drives anything until it is confined. No Niagara is ever turned into light and power until it is tunneled. No life ever grows great until it is focused, dedicated, disciplined." Here is the myth of the role of alignment in executing. You can train and reward independence and expect people to act cooperatively and interdependently. That's the old paradigm. The reality is, doing that is like trying to play tennis with a golf club, or having an analog mind in a digital world. Organizational structures and systems that encourage and reward independence and competition produce an independent culture. Water what you want to grow. When you train for and reward cooperation and interdependence, you get interdependent behavior. That is the new paradigm. So the first alternative to the aligning role of leadership would be to believe that the personal modeling of an individual is sufficient to keep an organization on a path of healthy growth. The second alternative would be to believe that by continuously communicating the vision and strategy that you've carefully and intentionally developed, you will be able to achieve your goals as an organization. Structure and systems are of secondary importance. The third alternative would be to first use both personal moral authority and formal authority to create systems that will formalize or institutionalize your strategy and the principles embodied in your shared vision and values. And second, to create cascading goals throughout the organization that are aligned with your shared vision, values, and strategic priorities. And third, to adjust and align yourself to regular feedback you receive from the marketplace and the organization on how well you are meeting needs and delivering value, which is one of the systems. If you say you value cooperation, you reward cooperation, not competition. If you say you value all stakeholders, you regularly gather information on all stakeholders and use it for realigning. In short, you water what you want to grow. The first role of leadership, modeling principle-centered living and leadership, creates and inspires trust. Pathfinding, the second role of leadership, creates shared vision and order without demanding them. But now the critical question becomes, how do we execute both values and strategy consistently without relying on the formal leader's continuing presence